You are listening to International Open Podcast. This is the official podcast of International Open Magazine. Please head over to internationalopenmagazine.com to see the show notes size of the podcast, articles and more information.
Derek. Nostrovia, Davaric, Derek.
Ah, comrade, welcome to Moscow.
And welcome to International Open Podcast Issue 5.
Now.
Derek, thanks for inviting me to Moscow.
My pleasure. I'm so happy that you were able to come all this way and get a visa to leave Vienna.
If you too need an American to invite you to Moscow in a posh hotel, just contact Derek. He will do that for you.
Well, I've been keeping my eye out for a really good conference to lure you to after we had our fun field trip adventure to Roma for the Roma Maker Fair. How long ago was that?
I think half a year, a bit more.
September? Yeah. No. Oh, it was October. It was during Code Week.
Yeah, it was 2015.
Yeah, the middle of October.
I should say we are now in Moscow and it's April 2016, the 15th April? 14th April is now. Okay, yeah.
Da.
And we are here, we are already on our second beer, and we are here because Derek invited me to speak at the International Education Fair Moscow, which I will do in 2 days.
And I Thanks spoke again, today. Derek. Yeah. Oh, my pleasure.
Derek.
They're lucky to have another Viennese here. My favorite Austrian.
Thanks. Derek, let's give a quick update since our last podcast. You was heading to Russia, and now you are a busy American employee in Russia. Is that correct?
I think you are employed. I was on working. One episode after my first trip to Moscow. Okay. I think.
But now you really have lived some months nonstop in Russia.
No, longest I've ever been. Well, I think it's been just about a month this time.
Okay.
I was in Vladivostok area for 2.5 weeks, and now I've been in Moscow for about 2 weeks. So yeah, I guess just over a month. This is the longest. I was here for 3 weeks in January and just a week in October into November. And I recorded International Open Podcast number 3.
With Sergey?
Yeah, in January when I was here. So that was my last time in Moscow.
And you managed to get employed here in Moscow as a foreigner, as an American?
Yes, I got an invitation for a Russian work visa.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with a 3-month visa, and then I've just filed for an extension. So as of next week, I should have a 1-year work visa, multi-entry visa for Russia. So finally, this will be my 4th visa, because counting the 3rd 3-month versus the 1 year. So 3rd visa just since October.
Okay.
When we came back from Rome, I was getting my first visa to Moscow, and that's only 6 months ago or something. Crazy.
What can you say about your Russian experience? I will make a lot of questions about the woman later, but just how is it working in Russia as an expatriate, as an foreigner?
I'm still learning. Yeah. It's very difficult to get paid in Russia if you don't have a work visa.
Okay.
So this is my first visit with a work visa. And
so you can now officially get paid.
So I can be on payroll for a company. But like I don't have a Russian bank account yet. So when I come back in June, the college that I'm going to be teaching at will set up a bank account to be able to pay me. I imagine they use direct deposit.
They try something funny like paying you in Bitcoin or fur or raw materials or crude oil?
No, old fashioned rubles. So it's, the difficulty for them hiring people from outside of Russia is the low exchange rate.
Yeah. So it's expensive.
So I wouldn't be able to live here if this was my only income. But because I still have paying clients in the US.
Yeah.
And income from my books, that allows me to consider living here at least part-time.
So you have now a pretty international lifestyle where you spend your income and your a way of living with low living costs.
Yeah, I try to bring American dollars here because they go a lot longer.
Spend them in Russia.
And very important, I try not to bring my rubles anywhere else because then I would just lose value if I was translating them into euros or dollars.
So basically you improving the Moscow local economy here.
Doing my part, my small part.
Yeah. Okay.
But hoping to get one of the books translated into Russian.
Yeah.
So that would be a real contribution.
For new listeners, your books, this is still the scratch book?
Yeah, I guess since the last time we spoke, I now have 3 books about scratch. So 2 new books just came out in the US last week. Still scratch. And they're what are called derivative titles. So they take a portion.
Okay.
They took just the game design projects for one book. And just the animation projects for another book, and I had to re-edit them. They had to be a very specific length. And frankly, that was not a fun process.
Okay.
Just sort of condensing your own
work. You told me you was not happy about it. Have you some funny story to report, like your first North Korean version or Antarctica version or Inuit dialects or something?
No, I mean, The irony is the French version has been out since November, but I haven't been to France or Canada since then, to any of the French-speaking countries.
Yeah.
So I still haven't even seen the French edition that came out. But for your listeners in Austria, the German edition was due out this week, at least Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about being in local bookstores, but I imagine it will be in local bookstores by the end of the month. But that is also a condensed version, and not only have I not seen it, I don't know what projects are in that book.
Do I understand correctly that all these decisions, who get a licensing, a translation license, and in how many part of the original work will make an edition in the translated language, are all decided by your publisher, not by you?
Yes, I have zero input on any of that.
You just did the original work and waived your rights, and they now make money with it.
Yeah, and I get a small commission for these other languages. The one that I'm most excited about is Chinese.
They're translating into
Chinese now, and my hope is that I'll travel to China in August and be able to meet people and hand them my book in Chinese. It'd be super cool.
Worldwide, Derek.
Yeah. But I don't know of any other languages that are imminent. But these newer books are much shorter. They're only 128 pages, so it's more likely that those will be translated into a wider number of languages. But in terms of income, it's very small. Okay. So I almost don't make enough to make it worth promoting other than believing in the work.
I see. Is it so that if you, let's say in France, you make some money, or better example would be Britain, who has his national currency, now, let's say you have a British version of your book, and if this version begin to sell, would you then generate an income in British pounds, or will that be automatically made in dollars from your American publishers?
Yeah, all of the money goes to the American publisher, and then they pay me.
Okay, so it's not that like you as an author have income and bank accounts in several countries and then can decide to change that in dollars or just leave them locally.
Not at all. And I think that's a challenge for countries like Russia because the exchange rate makes it less likely for them to translate work.
Yeah.
But what I have done in Russia is I was able to encourage a school to translate the community commons share alike Scratch curriculum developed at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about 100-page curriculum, and they're translating that into Russian, and they're almost finished.
And they can do that because of the free license.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's share alike, so anybody can not only translate it, but can also remix it, use portions of it any way that they wish. So it's pretty great. And we used some
for
of the pages
heroes
from that
of
today.
Our podcast. This should no news, but it's nice.
Yeah.
I cannot repeat it often enough.
What I like about that curriculum is it's also just a beautiful model for school curriculum.
Yeah.
So anybody who wants to develop curriculum for a school that follows a certain standard, this is like the gold standard for lesson plans and that sort of thing. for both teacher lesson plans and student. And now they've published a workbook version on Amazon of this creative computing curriculum workbook.
And this is also free licensed?
It's free licensed. You just pay for the printed version of the book.
Yeah. So it's, you will be able to fork it and modify it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you say what is your experience with the Russian education system so far as a foreigner, as your American perspective? Well, with your eyes as an American, yeah. I think you had contact with teachers and education people here and even schools. What is your impression?
Well, I have to make a disclaimer because I was invited by governmental officials to go to specific schools.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're great schools.
So they are the lighthouse projects.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've been to
Let me interrupt. The fact alone that you get from the top bureaucracy invited. Do you think there is a push from the government to push education forward?
Absolutely.
So it's a political move. We want to improve our education system.
I'm very impressed. I think that the sense that I have is that teachers are really celebrated in Russia more than in the United States.
You think this is a traditional thing coming back from Soviet era?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
So as a teacher, you hear more outer, so in society, you have a higher ranking than in some Western countries.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. There's still a division here because of the newer, like new media companies and international companies and things. Like anyone else, there are entrepreneurs who are very well compensated for their work.
Yeah.
But in terms of more like state jobs, I think teachers are, from what I've seen, very well respected. I really have a sense of that at the conference where I was.
So you think they're high educated people and teacher is not a job you do if you have. So it's a bad career move, so it's a good career move, so good pre-selection.
The teachers that I've met, by and large, are quite proud of the work that they do.
Yeah.
And many of them travel internationally, so I feel like they...
They're worldwide.
Yeah, they have an international perspective, or at least a European perspective, well beyond Russia. And so I've been really impressed with the actual education system from the student perspective too. So meeting a ton of students who even at a very young age are practically fluent in English.
Wow, yeah.
Which is so impressive. In the US it would be very hard to find.
We should say that you're now learning to read Russian, but basically you
very slowly.
Basically you can hear not even can communicate in the native language and getting paid and getting
none intact. Besides da and yet.
Yeah.
But the college where I'm going to be working, they have classes available in English.
Wow. Okay.
It's called the British Higher School of Art and Design.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the selling points for the courses that I'm going to be teaching for teenagers is that it's a way for them to improve their English.
Because you're a native speaker teaching. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what I'm told is it's easier for Russians to understand Americans. American English is a little clearer for them.
British English.
Even than British and particularly for anyone who grows up that isn't a native English speaker. But I was surprised to hear that it's easier for them to understand Americans than British.
Mm-hmm.
I think in no small part due to movies? Pop culture. Movies and music.
Yeah.
So I hear American music everywhere I go in Moscow.
Have you some insight into Russian TV? Because one of my theories is that if you have a TV that is not dubbed, so not translated, but in state subtitles.
Sure, with subtitles instead
of over voice-overed, so that you still can hear the original voice, that improve the ability of the population to learn English. My recording, but this is really 20 years past, was that it was standard for Russian TV not to have a completely voice, so not completely translation of the films, but instead some narrator who explain in a Russian voice what actually is said and happened.
It's like a commentator,
but you still could hear the their original.
I can't comment so much about Russian TV, but this is something I asked Sergey about. I don't know if it was on the podcast though.
We will postpone it to the
next. I'm hoping that we'll get an interview with him.
But your impression as an American was that the level of English among teachers and students is very high.
Yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised with how easy it was to communicate with people since my first time in Russia. But it's funny you mention about dubbing and things. I just watched a documentary last week on Netflix about underground films in Romania.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, it has Chuck Norris in the title. I think it's Chuck Norris Conquers Communism or something like that. But it's a feature-length documentary that is looking at thousands of films in the 80s that were dubbed by one woman.
Mm-hmm.
She would dub the entire film on VHS. So people all over Romania would watch these awful copies of VHS films where they could barely see what was happening, but they would hear this one woman's voice. And so for an entire generation or two, this woman is the voice of all
of every West American,
particularly American. In fact, I don't remember them mentioning any other films other than American and then some of like the Bruce Lee films, which were from Hong Kong, but practically American films. Like really interesting. And they were talking about all the ways that it expanded their horizons, their understanding of the West at a time when they had no, they only had one television station, which would only broadcast a few hours a day. So it was a really restrictive time.
On the contrary, I think it's the same in Austria, but I think if I remember our first podcast well, you said that in America, even in cinemas, it's very unusual to have a film not fully translated. It would be art house or student film who come in original language, but it's not.
It's only maybe a handful of films. I'd say less than 10 a year that get a theatrical release as dubbed international films. I'm sorry, as subtitled. Dubbed is almost unheard of. I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen a film in a theater in the U.S. that was dubbed.
Dubbed
from
means
another language. Where they record an English language track. So like if you in Moscow in Russia, for instance. Most American films are dubbed into Russian.
Yeah, so you have a national voice over.
Yeah.
And that even does not happen in America.
No, dubbing is very rare. Usually
so
it just...
Do we make the whole film then? Or?
No, well, it's more likely to see a remade film than to see even a subtitled film in theaters. They pretty much have to get nominated for an Academy Award. Not exactly. Something commercial like a film like Let the Right One In, where it's a vampire film, maybe some action, so some things, but pretty rare. Something like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Okay, that we all have seen because of the dialogue.
And so I should mention, we're drinking Czech beer, introduced by Sergey to me on podcast number 3, I think.
On the hilt of Sergey.
Cheers.
Okay, so you was, with your experience so far with teachers and students alike, you was impressed of the level of English?
Yeah.
You had an easy time communicating?
It makes me feel worse and worse about being monolingual. I mean, I studied French in both high school and college and can barely get by in French as it is. But they're also, I think they're surprised to learn that Russian was not available at almost any level of education because of my age. So being 46, we're about the same age. In the 1970s and 80s, Russian would have been one of the least popular languages in the U.S. because of the Cold War.
But I just speculate that did not the CIA or some military agencies had a need to train Russian translators?
Well, that's one of the places. And in fact, I tried to become, I wanted to be in intelligence when I was in the Navy.
Yeah.
I applied for intelligence, and I was quite interested in studying Russian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'd forgotten this until just recently when I was coming here. But I wanted to ask you, so Russian news stories that I've been following the past few weeks have been really emphasizing the strong ties between Austria and Russia, which resonated with me even more as I was thinking about you coming to Moscow.
I'm not on a government mission. I think this is a current political diplomatic game.
But is it also being covered widely in Austrian
press?
Not
so much, no.
So it's much more on the Russian side.
Yeah, I think. So if you listen to that some years in the future, at the moment I think Russia is still under sanction because of the war with Ukraine, and maybe the Austria tried to probe missions or some what else. We historically since the Cold War, Austria had a reputation of being a small neutral country and had better tiers diplomatic wise if the big blocs could not. I'm just here because of your invitation to hold us speak about teaching with open source.
Is this the furthest you've ever been from Vienna?
In the east, yes.
Cool.
Yep.
Was it the first time that you had to get a visa?
No, I remember that when I was a kid, it was before the European Union, I once had to apply to a visa to go to France.
Mm.
But, yeah. Well, I successfully got a visa. It was a very nice experience. But I wanted to ask you, you told about the high level of English that you have seen in Russian schools, but you also mentioned you was probably shown the more elite schools and not some rural schools with bad funding. What is your impression about the level of IT, about computer education in these schools that you have seen and about students and teachers? Do you have seen good computer rooms, good computer knowledge?
Well, I'm about to break your heart first, because the schools that I saw had MacBooks.
Had MacBooks. Everything that is expensive.
Yeah, and that was something that surprised me just because I didn't expect to see it in public schools.
Yeah.
Even in the U.S., it's a mix.
Yeah.
But I think what's good about MacBooks from an IT perspective is the generally lower maintenance cost and more resistant to viruses.
Yeah.
Of course, Linux is the same, but...
Okay, but I mean that alone is an indicator that there is money, at least in the schools you have visited.
At least two of the schools, maybe all three now that I'm thinking of it, children were working on MacBook Pros, so the most expensive laptops available, really.
Yeah, yeah. And
solid Wi-Fi, and two of the schools had smart boards.
Smart boards, okay.
And that really surprised me. The first time I went into the very first school that I went into had a smart board. And
are
I
we
thought,
talking
wow,
about
I wasn't
the same
note
that the teacher can have basically a big touch screen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like an electronic whiteboard.
Instead of chalkboard or the?
Yeah.
What's the physical name for the?
Chalkboard or whiteboard.
And did was your impression that they're making use of it, or is there still stuff at new toys to
I didn't see a lot of instruction happening in the schools because typically I was being brought to teach workshops.
Okay.
So I would get a tour of the school that would be quite brief, and then going right into doing teaching. And I was at a school last week, but it was during a holiday, so there were no students there.
I have read that Little Estonia has now mandatory programming curriculum for every student until a certain age. Did you hear something in this direction about Russia, or some ideas about that, so that at least introduction to computer programming becomes part of the mandatory syllabus?
I've definitely heard of prioritizing computer education, but not mandatory.
Okay.
So I haven't heard that yet, but I also, I can't say that I'm following the press as closely, not reading.
We will follow up soon.
Right now I'm mostly dependent on Google News, I have a Russian channel in Google News, so I read Russian stories, but of course in English.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's as nearly as deep as if I was going through newspapers or something. But I've been talking to a lot of people in IT education.
And?
I'm quite excited about this group at this Scola 1329. Mm-hmm. So, School 1329, where they're creating like a scratch lab.
Well,
a dedicated place where they can do research and do teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the school that's also translating the scratch guide. So, super impressive. And I was co-facilitating a workshop with the, assistant director from that school today. So very cool. Or we would say kruta. Kruta is like cool for, it's a slang word. I'm told it's a word that teachers generally wouldn't use in school.
But the students are not.
If the director was visiting the class. Okay. Yeah, so sort of young slang.
Very stupid question, because we both were raised during the Cold War. And now, if you read newspapers, it's always a bit colder and the end is more nearer. And so, what is your, reception as an American, as a former arch enemy? You've also raised that the Russian will end the world with a nuclear warheads and Armageddon is near. And now you're working and living in Russia and you have a lot of interaction with people, meet a lot of Russians. How are you received as an American?
By and large, I would say I feel very welcome and popular.
Popular.
Almost like a minor celebrity as an American.
Yeah.
And I don't think, sometimes of course it's being introduced as a writer from America, but I think even just being American, if people hear me speaking English or trying to speak Russian very badly,
how do you
usually react? They smile or laugh, which is a good sign.
Okay.
So I feel sort of honored. I actually feel a little bit bad about it because I don't feel like I earned it. I'm just this guy from the U.S., not even a very successful guy. Yeah. Sometimes I wonder if they really understood that I'm from a working class family. But here, particularly over the past few years, a lot of the expatriates have been leaving. A lot of American companies have left.
Okay.
So I have
this
sense
because of the political situation at the moment?
Yeah, okay. I mean, at least as far as companies.
Yeah,
leaving. So I think that it's becoming more rare for people to meet Americans here. But I also think it will be so interesting to hear your perspective in a day or two once you've been at the conference meeting people to see if you have a similar experience as being Austrian, but really as being from outside of Russia versus any specific country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when I was near Vladivostok, the people were just sort of dumbfounded, I think, they were so surprised to meet an American, to hear English.
But Vladivostok is vis-a-vis from Alaska, so it's not so far from
true. But I don't know that there's a lot of flights. There are many flights between Alaska and Vladivostok. Like it's a pretty far destination for people to go. Yeah.
You had some typical virtue of telling us experiences in Russia so far, like some moment. Now that I know that I'm in Russia, like the Russian YouTube video of dark Russians or something.
Good question. What? As soon as you mention experience of Russia, the first thing I think about is something I talked about on another podcast, which is the subway, the metro.
Yeah.
In Moscow, some of the most beautiful metro stations you'll see tomorrow, like marble floors and walls and sculptures and paintings
from the Soviet
and frescoes.
Era.
Yeah. And so, my thought when I was here the first time was, oh, this must be because they celebrate the worker.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, the subway is like the quintessential place for the workers to gather and spend time And so you really feel like you're in a place that honors people. And many of the stations have these iconic paintings or sculptures of common people, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Tomorrow you'll see the conference, the exposition site, which has some really iconic, like, Soviet sculptures, like huge sculptures.
So working man with flags.
Stuff like that. You'll see right over the gates. Mm-hmm. Like when you look in different directions, you can see huge human sculptures in different directions, kind of bringing people into the, because this is where the World Fair was. And, it's one of my favorite places in Moscow because it feels so
What's the name
Russian.
Of this area, this exhibition
it's
area?
It's the, or? Oh, you had the,
I will write it, please, yeah. Look in the show notes at internationalopenmagazine.org podcast.
I think Russian Exposition Park, or okay, I'm not
we,
sure
we
exactly.
Will, I will have you located it in the show notes.
Yeah, we should put a image of the map in the show notes.
I will, yeah.
But very cool, and one of my favorite things there is this incredible sort of statue monument for Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space.
First
it's
cosmonaut.
Really cool, like Sputnik thing that's huge. Like, and so that really impressed me the first time that I went to a conference there.
I'm here only a half day. It's my first half day in Russia, but I already had a Russian moment.
Really? Yeah. Tell me.
I was growing up that we had always learned that the Russians have so harsh conditions to live in, the winter and Soviet system and so they're very good at improvising technical things, yes? We have even a saying in German that if something is very hacked, also the mechanics hacked, also like not like it should be, but so that it is working somehow, yes, then we say this is very Russian made. Yeah? Mm. And I was picked up by a driver from the airport, so I get in a cab, and the driver had I think it was a Skoda, and he had a big tablet. The tablet was functioning as his GPS system, navigation system, with a and normally my experience was with such devices, even if it's not built in the car, it's at least attached to the car by some kind of sucking devices or glue, somehow glued on the car,
like,
or attached or with some flexible clip. Here it was not so. Instead, the guy had a glove department, basically a slit in the next to the steering wheel, where you can put gloves or sunglasses. Uh-huh. And in this slit, which was maybe 20 centimeters times 4 centimeters, he had a big chunk of wood, like a, how you call it, not a brick, but of wood. Longer and thinner than a brick. A piece of wood.
Sure.
Yeah. The piece of wood had exactly the dimensions of this gloves department and a bit more, so it was standing out. And in a right angle on this wood brick, he had attached the navigation device with a rubber band, pressing it to the wood. It was for me really funny to see. I think, this guy, he was not waiting to get a special attachment, clip device, delivered. He just made it his own, but he hacked it together.
Yeah, you just reminded me that I've had a few rides with drivers from airports or between places who got lost.
Yeah.
Which is something that would be almost unheard of in the U.S. or in other big cities.
That there are so much building sites going on.
I think so. Yeah. I think that was part of it. And one time I was getting really judgmental and then found out that it was because of when there are certain holidays, they block off entire areas of the city.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And so that was a case where he was trying to get to a hotel, a specific hotel, and couldn't go the normal way. And then I felt really bad about it. I felt like, man, I'm so judgmental. What do I know? I don't know what's going on. Where people have been so friendly. And actually the only time I've had trouble communicating with people was drivers, who had been hired to pick me up and bring me somewhere who had zero English.
Yeah.
But each time I'm sort of like, oh good. Like, there should be more people like this. It should be harder for me to communicate. It's their city.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be trying to accommodate.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, everywhere I go, people are talking about more ways that they either think the city should be or that the city is preparing to accommodate English speakers, whether it's street signs or subway.
So Moscow is trying to go international, so to speak.
And English in particular. Like, I don't see many, if any, other languages.
Yeah.
But in the subways, one thing that's so helpful that someone had to point out to me is if you look down, a lot of the subway stations have added signs in English
on the ground.
Floor, the only thing that's unfortunate is none of us know to look down at the floor. We're just not used to seeing text there. But once it's pointed out, it's so helpful because the subway stations can be really vast and some of them have, excuse me, three stations side by side, and on the map it looks like they're the same station, but you actually have to go quite a ways. Yeah, so I'm still a tourist. I'm still nowhere near.
But today you delivered a workshop and a speak. Can you speak about your experience at the International Education Fair Moscow?
I did a brief talk, just a 15-minute talk on instructional design, which talking is not my strong point. Mm-hmm. I'm much more confident delivering workshops.
I must say, Derek is underplaying enormously here. He's a very gifted stage performer.
Well, that's different though from giving a talk that has real meaning. I think sometimes my reputation is based on being entertaining and not necessarily being informative. Mm. And I really felt it today because I was speaking to an audience that had only basic English, and I didn't have a lot of my usual props. I couldn't use my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really set up for the way that I do talks, demonstration type things. So that meant it really stripped away a lot of my comfort, and I felt really raw. But the workshop was great, in part because I co-facilitated with a woman from Moscow, from that school that I mentioned. And so we were able to introduce, I think, close to 40 teachers to Scratch.
Cool.
Maybe half of them are already using Scratch in their schools. We emphasized game design because that's often the hardest thing for teachers to get into. It was great. And the first half of the workshop, I mostly presented my sort of techniques for engaging students in designing a game together. And then the second part was the Russian teacher administrator talking about using Scratch across the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So for history and Russian classes and
that's really something very cool. I think that it's hard to pull off if you have not engaged workforce really natively want to do that. You cannot, basically not command it. I mean, you can command it, but it will not work.
And this was the perfect place to do it because we had a number of primary school teachers who are responsible for teaching all the different courses. But my favorite part was in between a 10-year-old student from the very first school where I taught and visited. He presented his Scratch game.
Cool.
So I was so fortunate that the college where I'm going to be teaching teenagers, the woman who teaches a parallel program for teens at the college, talk about what a small world it is. Her son goes to the school that I visited first and my first visit in Moscow, and she was there at the first Scratch workshop that I gave in a Russian school. So when we met again last week, she reminded me that she was in the room when I taught Scratch and that her son really enjoyed it and that he's still using Scratch.
So you had a good feedback.
Yeah. And of course, my first thought was, oh, you've got to bring him to this workshop so he could help the teachers. But we had so many more teachers that had used Scratch before that I wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little disappointed that they weren't asking him so many questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when he presented his game, his mother had been worried, or she basically told me, I don't know how comfortable he'll be speaking. He might not want to talk.
He spoke Russian.
He spoke Russian.
Yeah.
I spoke English for the first half. he presented his game in Russian. Mm-hmm. And actually, we couldn't get him away. He was so excited with his game, all the code.
Yeah, cool. So he discussed the code of his game.
Yeah, and the more he talked about it, the more confident he was. Yeah, cool. Only 10, he might be 11 now. Yeah, he was 10 nice, when I was first here. But yeah, so great. Yeah. And he is going to be coming to some of the workshops I'm teaching for teens at the design college. And he's going to help me with Scratch when we introduce animation to the teens. And then he'll be there for the HTML. The first day of web design, we'll do just HTML. Maybe a tiny bit of CSS. Because I think... Now, I do think it's very good for students to learn HTML first. Mm-hmm. But the main reason why I do it is it's fun. Students really enjoy typing a little bit of code, opening up in a web browser, and having it display something. I'm sure you've had similar experiences.
Actually, I had the inverse
experience.
I mean, I have a lot of students I teach actually HTML, and they're also interested in that, but in Austria, at least the higher education have mandatory HTML. But I remember teaching young adults, 20-year-olds, Microsoft Office skills, and there was a tiny bit of HTML in it, and they really hated it because they said, oh, why must I type? I want to click with my mouse on shiny icons. It can go both ways.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if how much of it is presentation, but also it sounds like it's inside a pretty rigid curriculum, which is not a good way so much. I have the advantage that I mostly do informal teaching, like you do after school.
Okay. Any summary of your experience in Russia so far? I did purposefully not questioned about women.
Well, I mean...
If I can sum you up so far, you had a good experience. You was not seen as a former arch enemy from the Cold War, but more as a curiosity or the first American native speaker they probably have seen, and you had a met very friendly welcome. Isn't that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Even more so, I feel like I've been so warmly welcomed. Part of it might be starting with a conference, so I'm kind of hoping that you have a similar experience when you present, and also doing some educational internet television stuff. So it's kind of fun.
I completely forget. How was your first time in Russian national education TV? You had a TV show or something.
I mean, the first one I think I spoke about maybe on International Open Podcast number one or two or something like that. I'm trying to remember. No, because we did
I've seen
first
some
one
YouTube videos you sent
that.
Me where you present in English, and I think then a narrator also explained it in Russian.
My favorite was the first one, in part because I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. It was the same day that I went to the first school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a school in the morning, presented a Scratch workshop, had a lot of fun with the kids, only maybe not more than 20 kids, maybe 16 to 18 kids. And then this guy brings me to this television studio, and I don't really understand what's happening.
And you had a live audience there?
I had a live audience. So we were on a sound stage.
Can you explain what a sound stage is a bit?
Yeah, so like when you see a news show or a game show, or anywhere they have one set stage with multiple cameras set up, and usually a studio audience, like that's the classic.
So to give real applause stage. And real love.
So it really was, there were, I'd say at least maybe 50 or 60 adults, and then maybe more than 20 students, or about 20 students maybe, because initially there were probably 14 to 16 students who were were on camera with computers. But because I do things a little bit weird, I actually brought all the people out of the audience onto the stage at the beginning.
Yeah.
So right from the beginning of the show, you see everybody in the audience all together in a circle playing
this
game.
And it was funny? Or...
I don't, It was fun for me. Yeah. I think people got into it. They seem relatively happy.
But had the audience computers, or could they try out what you showed them?
Only there were two long tables set up with laptops.
Yeah.
So initially it was just about half the kids actually doing Scratch. And then there were these kids in the audience.
Okay.
And it felt really weird to me. I've never had that experience before, especially with kids. If it was just adults in the audience, it wouldn't have felt
so
weird.
So it was basically kids without computer watching kids with computer.
Yeah, felt weird. And we were designing games. So about partway through, I started to realize, I think we have enough time. Maybe I could switch and get the other kids to come. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I had that thought, I got really excited because I thought maybe I could engage the first group of kids into helping the second group.
To become teachers,
And that worked so well that I was able to interact with the audience while the first kids, taught the second kids. So it was really cool. I don't know if it was broadcast live.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know.
But what was, did some regie or production guy come running to you? No.
But I think they must have been losing their mind right from the beginning when I'm bringing everybody up. And then there were some Wi-Fi problems with my laptop. Okay. And the screen kept going out. Yeah. So it was the most surreal experience.
And did the production guys afterwards talk to you about this?
Not at all. They were very welcoming when I came back.
Oh, okay. So
a few months later, when I returned to Moscow, I found out that show was very popular with teachers and with kids.
Cool, yeah.
Kids enjoyed watching other kids learning.
Yeah,
And it's something, it didn't surprise me so much because I used to like watching shows like that when I was young. Mm. But the people at the TV studio were definitely surprised. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we still don't know how much of it was that it was an American, that it was kids, that it was Scratch.
That it was some kind of unscripted.
Yeah. But what we found out is that people were watching it as families, or people are watching it in schools. And, I can only take a small amount of credit because much of it was unexpected and impromptu, and the kids.
But
some
you
of it
get
luck.
No contract to do this show.
No. When I went back in January, I recorded another hour-long program. Mm-hmm. You finish. I've got plenty here. And the hour-long program, I did just one Scratch project, and that was just me on camera. That was more of a traditional approach, where I was just doing this Anna Frank.
But you're not some kind of national TV,
No, because it's internet TV. So it's not like I'm on some state channel.
It's not broadcasted,
like
national.
No.
Okay.
But, the TV studio is operated by the Moscow Department of Education. So Moscow has
state
its own.
Sponsored. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well.
But I'm hoping
but
that,
of impact,
I'm hoping that you get
I mean,
to see
you at least theoretically now can impact a whole generation in a whole country.
I don't know about that, but I do like that those shows are broadcast in all Moscow city schools. Mm. So my hope is that at least there'd be some children or some teachers that are intrigued and want to explore more and kind of dig into these creative computing things. But I always have to give a disclaimer. And I did it a lot today where people are coming up and they assume that I'm a programming guru, if not genius, especially if they see MIT or something. But I am so far from any kind of programming master. Like, you are a much deeper programmer than I am in teaching true programming. So that's something that I really celebrate. Design is something that I'm more focused on. But I'm so happy that people are exploring all these new ways of using computers.
Let's talk about today. You had a little speech today at the International Education Fair in Moscow, and also you had a workshop?
Yeah.
How was the workshop?
The workshop was very rewarding. So I really enjoyed having that kid there. I think he really made it work. Mm-hmm. And the
workshop was for teachers?
It was for teachers.
Okay.
So we had, I think, between 30 and 40, almost exclusively teachers. We set the limit at 50 people, and we intentionally invited teachers and specifically mentioned primary school teachers because that's, I think, the best fit for Scratch. Mm-hmm. And those were maybe the teachers that I thought wouldn't have as much experience with Scratch or as much exposure, but I was pleasantly surprised that so many had used it before. The talk was much more challenging. So I think that was more of a learning experience for me, but fortunately I had been told to expect as many as 3,000 people in the audience, and it was closer to like 40, okay, which is a big difference. In fact, there were fewer people at my talk today than in October.
Yeah.
And I was much happier with that talk because I was able to demonstrate Scratch, and that was more challenging to do today.
Something you look forward to for the next days of the International Education Fair Conference?
The talk by Horst Jens from Vienna, Austria.
I must confess that at this time of recording, this talk is not even finished. So I'm still working on the slides. So I can
I have absolutely no comment.
I
have this secret hope because I heard that the Secretary of Education for Austria was here yesterday. And so my hope is that person will be here on Saturday. And so there'll be one native German speaker going, why isn't he speaking German? Why is he speaking English? I think it'd be hilarious. But maybe
try
we'll
to have my sickest accent.
And what you should do if you meet, you should say, I've come all the way from Vienna to meet you.
I better say nothing now. Well, I admire very much the capacity of Derek to speak fluently English after so much beer. Mine is beginning to fade.
But you notice no Russian.
No Russian, yeah. Well, we will experience Moscow Education, International Education Fair in Moscow
in
the next
days.
And
how about in a day or two we'll switch roles and I'll interview you.
Okay.
I think that would be really fun.
Okay, I sadly have to finish now because my brain is starting to lose control.
And we're almost out of beer. So.
Yeah, that's a good indicator that the podcast should end for now. We will continue in a few hours.
Oh. Das Vidania.
Das Vidania. Wow, we really talked 1 hour.
Issue 5, last part of International Open Podcast with Derek Breen and Horst Jens.
So this is the part of the podcast where we get to hear Horst's impressions of Moskva, Russia. Horst, what has been the most memorable parts of your weekend in Russia?
There are a lot of pretty women here.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You think more than Vienna?
I think more than everywhere I was. The density is extremely high.
Ah, so overwhelmed by beautiful Russian women.
Yeah. I normally feel a bit out of shape, but here I feel like an ogre walking.
So do you think that people are generally in better shape in Russia than in Austria or other parts of Europe?
I did not notice that the men here look particularly attractive or slim or sportive, but I was naturally more looking at the woman. We discussed it a previous night in a restaurant, and your theory was, because it's incredible, there are a lot of very slim, very attractive women. And in the first days I come here, I ask you, do they have normal looking women also, or do they shove them off to some Siberian town far away, but your theory, if I remember, was that the nutrition here is better. It's not so much processed food.
Well, I think particularly in the 70s, 80s, maybe into the 90s, so the processed food came in Europe and the US and other first world countries maybe decades before it did in Russia. That's the sense that I have from talking to a few different people about this. Because I also thought that people appeared more fit in Russia, generally speaking. Interesting. But in addition, it's not just beautiful women. You've had some other experiences in Russia. How about this?
Just let's finish this point, because you also philosophed that maybe
there's from the Soviet era a more broad sports system. That sport mm-hmm. education is more a national priority, and that works.
I have a sense athletics for children. Maybe yeah. more children are encouraged to be athletic, or maybe it's more integrated in the yeah. schools.
But it's really, I started philosophing, wow, we in the West with all, so my impression is that in Europe there's less obesity than maybe is in US, but it's coming mm-hmm. and trending. And maybe in 10 years in Russia they will have the same problems. But wow, what we give up in national health, so to speak, just for having cheap food. It's a trade-off that no one consciously made.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, and that's something that you would think we would have started to learn, because you have this impression of third world countries that mm. obesity isn't even an issue, that it's something that, so it is really a first world problem.
Rich man's problem.
Yeah. Crazy.
You also told me that you spoke with teachers here, and they said that now in children camps, the first fat kids show up, but it's a phenomenon, it's not the norm.
Yeah, what I said, out of 250 children at this camp where I was teaching, where children were being gathered from different parts of Russia, not necessarily mm. cities, there were just a few children who were overweight.
And that possibly
which is
from
far
cities,
lower than what I'm used to. Yeah, yeah. So from the eastern part of Russia, all over the eastern part. So this conference, You had the experience now.
You're now talking about international education conference.
Yes, the international
International
Moscow,
Education Fair.
Moscow International Education Fair.
Yes.
Although they there's a different interpretation from in Russian, which I'm not remembering. Mm. But a few days ago, you presented. Could you tell us a bit about your talk and how?
Yeah. So I was more or less invited by you, so you organized that I got invited, and I had really no idea about the crowd and about the level of English language skill of my audience and the level of computer skill or pre-knowledge. So I was not sure, do I talk to a lot of informatic professors who already teach that, or do I talk to a standard crowd of fair visitors? Mm-hmm. And then as I've seen the very small room where the talk was, all my panic also got completely away, because I think, okay, this room is smaller than most of the classrooms I hold workshops, so whatever the crowd is, I can handle that. It's not an intimidating crowd. And it was in this huge hall where the International Education Fair was. There were a lot of small, let's say 10 by 10 meter rooms, separated with walls so that you can have speeches or little conferences. And mm-hmm. I was one of the speaker in one of these little conference rooms, and we had a crowd of, I think, between 20 and 50 people, not even 50.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was nice. I had, for the first time in my life, my own translator. It was a nice lady, and I met her a bit before and spoke about, and she said she was not too busy. She was booked for all the day of the conference, and she said to me she had one Spanish and one Greek guy to translate, but I think between them she had also pauses. So
wow. How many languages does she speak? Did she say?
No, she was always translating from English into Russian.
I see.
Greek guy spoke his Greek English, and she translated his Greek English into Russian. So English is the...
So I should ask, how many accents does she understand?
Possibly a lot. Yes. And then 10 minutes, that talk was scheduled for 25 minutes, I know that. And then I think 10 minutes before I ask her, translate simultaneously, should I speak slow? And she said, no, you speak one sentence, I translate.
Uh-huh.
Before that, we timed our speech. I made a training with you, and I note, okay, I must compress the speech a bit. And then basically she told me 5 minutes before, you only have half the time, because... But I think I managed. I spoke about my experience teaching open source, about diverse German-speaking education Linux distros I know, and their failings and successes with teachers I know, and a bit about my own experience, and I gave a bit overview about free software from Stallman. So I think it was a good rounded-up talk.
Cool.
And you said I was photographed a lot?
Yeah, there were several photographers there. I'd say at least three professional photographers. So you're probably all over Russian press this weekend.
Yes, with my belly. And at first I was thinking, yeah, they're now photographing me because I'm one of the few international speakers. But then you said they were photographing the slides.
Well, there were the attendees were photographing the slides.
Ah, so that was real from the audience.
Yeah, it was them wanting to remember things in your talk.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So the talk is online. It's a Google Doc talk, and on the talk on the left upper corner is a short URL
where you can access. So you can link to it in the show notes.
Of course, it will be linked. Okay. And I got from Derek the idea to maybe expand this talk and write some kind of essay or longer version of the talk with all the things I wanted to say. Yeah. And then I can hold this talk like Stallman over and over in cities where I get travel expense paid.
And the last time we spoke, you hadn't been to the fair yet. So what about general impressions of the fair itself, of the conference?
Of the education fair?
Yeah.
Well, I can only compare to very smaller education fairs in Austria that I'm more familiar with. And I think all this education business is in the we sell dreams to parents business. Basically, they have... I've seen a booth in the education fair, Oxford Institute or something. The rest was Cyrillic. I could not read. But I have seen the same Oxford something in Austria or Germany. So basically, if you're a rich parent, and then of course you want the best for your child, and this is the market that they are serving. Mm-hmm. So you take as much money from the parents as you can to give a good brand name that maybe has nothing to do with the real city of Oxford or the real University of Oxford, and hopefully that the outcome is not so bad.
Yeah.
I'm a bit critical to all that because I was working in a company who was a bit in this line of business, also selling high price education. And yeah. But basically, it's also my business. I sell computer courses for children. Of course, the children want it, but also the parents think, yes, and my son will have a very good future because he can now programming in the age of 12. So we all sell dreams to parents. It was a bit going in my head. And the other expression that I can say is I felt I was one of the most international parts of this international education fair, so it was all in Cyrillic. On Saturday I was there, I have seen no one talk in English, so, and generally speaking, I think it was more a national education conference, not an international, but it's okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I also have no insight how much maybe the international was more about other countries from the Cyrillic speaking hemisphere, also Cyrillic alphabet hemisphere, like former Soviet republics and so on.
It's also
valid to call that international. It's just not the international that I suppose as a Westerner.
Yeah, it was tricky to navigate. There was an English language website that was a limited version of the full website, and they didn't translate the program, so it was only available in Russian.
But why? I mean, the most international people were sellers resellers, and then for them to translate all it would have not been cost efficient.
Yeah. And it didn't seem like there were services being offered beyond Russia. In other words, it was international people marketing to people in Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't seem like there were Russians trying to market to international.
No. That would really make sense at a global education fair. But maybe it is also the business of education fairs is very local because you basically sell to the local parents.
Yeah.
I've seen Microsoft have a booth. I've seen German companies. I was very impressed how strong Germany is in exporting business in fields that I was not associating with it, like education business and Fischertechnik is a toy like Lego that I played with as a child. They make education games. And then what I really loved, I had the opportunity to speak with some students of a university. They were marketing their university and they had like a little drone. It was a toy buggy, and they flanged a Raspberry Pi or Arduino into it and made it remote control, oh, and then they showed a quadrocopter with a Raspberry Pi. So it's exactly the same kind of projects that hackerspaces in Vienna will do, or good universities or good technical high schools with an engaged professor all over the world. They're now all playing with the same open source tools, with the same hardware like the Raspberry Pi, applying it to the same technique like drones. It's very cool. It's like a global movement of hackers and that coming, infiltrating education. I was very happy about that.
Did you want to say something about that? There was kind of a parallel event happening for kids in the same huge complex on the other side when we went in, where they had the kids with all the robotics.
Yeah, stuff. I was only short visiting it. You possibly best suited to tell about it because
almost like they were waiting for you. As soon as we went into that room, there were these people waltzing on the stage. Do you remember?
Yeah, this was very pretty, but I did not understood if it was to entertain the crowd or if they make advertising for dance school or something.
I think it was purely entertainment, but because that whole event was about robotics competitions. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't, I don't think they'd be marketing dance schools in a robotics competition. I went in a few times and they had different entertainments, basically trying to keep it going, because that competition had been going for 4 days, which seems like a long time for robotics, but people from all over Russia. Tons of students.
I must chip in. There is an international robo, worldwide soccer games, but they are in Vienna each year. And there are teams from all over the world competing. So there's robo sumo, where you build little robots. Sumo wrestling and robo football and some other challenges. I was covering that once in a German podcast. It's very cool.
Is that something you've ever been interested in doing with your students who you're teaching programming to?
Yeah, let's say a bit interesting, but actually that is more to logistic and financial problems. If I have now 5 students, I would need 5 kits of a robotic hardware. Usually they're expensive and not scale very well.
Yeah.
So I concentrate on software because this is more my strong part. Sometimes children come to me with their own hardware kits and I help them, mostly the programming part, but I did not found out a way of doing business with hardware cost efficiently. If I would have unlimited funds, I could buy unlimited pieces of Lego Mindstorm or whatever.
Sure.
But it's more a financial question for me. Also, something simple like Mitch Altman is doing these soldering workshops for kids. I admire this greatly. I think this is very great. But for that, you need a set of soldering workplaces. So you need a place where you can do that.
Yeah. Big, you need really good ventilation.
That, and you need a lot of sets of soldering irons. And I'm not sure how much workshops I really could do with them. So if I buy only 2, it's not cost, I would never get the money back from just having 2 students. And if I buy 10 for having maybe 3 students, I pay enough to have good computer hardware, and I concentrate more on the software at the moment.
I think that makes good sense. How about the place where the fair was happening, this exhibition center in Moscow?
Yes, this is a very nice place with gigantic Soviet style statues of working heroes and a big Sputnik, I think. And yeah, it's a nice place. Sadly, we had bad weather, so we could not fully enjoy it, but I think it's a nice spot to be in Moscow if it's sunny and warm. I could figure, because there were no cars, a giant car-free zone with little lunar park. And yeah, it must be nice to go there for a conference or so.
And there was a surprise for you in the lunar park. Something from home. Do you remember you had to take a photograph of one thing in the amusement park?
Yes, there was one, how you say?
A roller coaster?
A roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And it had a German name, Wilde Maus. So I think it is somehow transferred from Munich Oktoberfest or from a German roller coaster. It was traded for something, but it was funny to see Moscow roller coaster advertising a German name.
And then we spent some time away from the conference yesterday.
Let me recap the conference, because that's more possibly more interesting for the audience. I must say, it was a real pleasure to walk with Derek around in Moscow and go on education fair with him, because every 5 minutes some very interesting person is, hello, Derek, and like this TV guy who has run this TV show, educational TV, you said, and then several women who were entrepreneurs in the education scene and all speak perfect English and were had exciting products. The one, I think she's selling wooden toys.
Mm-hmm. Wooden kits for making bridges and houses for engineering principles.
That was very cool. Yeah. And then we met Pavel. Mm-hmm. Pavel, and we have him on interview. Yeah. So you probably now hear it already, or depending on how I cut this. And he asked me some question, and then he had very interesting insights for me about Russian education system and government push behind education. Mm-hmm. It was very well. It was for me a very rich experience meeting all these people, and it was made because I attached myself to Derek.
Oh, my pleasure. It's like I'm your scout. Yeah. I get to Moscow a few.
So you should make a business out of it. Let's meet interesting people in Moscow. Yeah. Just
or you send me to different cities, and I'll
And you will. You will magnetize.
I'm like the dog on the fox hunt.
You're the lure.
Sniff out interesting people.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else about the conference?
I think it was a fair, not a conference. You was in the conference part. I was in the exhibition part. Of course, on a fair, you always have the people more dressed up and the girls are more pretty and all people are selling something. So it's a bit, an overdressed situation, but it was extremely extreme because I think it was in Moscow. And one little detail I have not seen in other countries, at least not in Central Europe countries. And that was they were closing the fair. We were on the time of leaving. And then, some young people from a booth, I think for university or something, one girl was starting dancing and the others made a circle and clapped and then a boy joined in. So they made some kind of Cossack dance too. But it was very, very nice. It was spontaneous.
Yeah.
And I think, well, that's a nice place where the young people at age 20 something, spontaneously break into dance just to celebrate that a work day is finishing and now it's the party time is starting.
Yeah.
It was not like they're making fake hip hop moves and bobbing their heads. It was real dance. And I enjoyed that really.
Cool.
I think it speaks about the mentality of the youth here.
And does it make you curious to go to other such events in other countries? Do you think it's worthwhile to be going to events like this in different countries to get different perspectives? Or is it still pretty similar to what you're used to from other countries?
Even as a foreigner who don't know Russian, who cannot read Cyrillic, I had the impression it's the same everywhere. The students in the technical schools showing the same cool projects to attract students, pondering the same questions, how I make drones, how I make cool robotics. The salesmen in the institutes like Oxford's Institute of Learn Really Good English trying to, with the same arguments, sell the same courses to the same rich parents. So if you're not a salesperson or not... So for a salesperson, it may be worth going to different markets. But for shopping, as a consumer side, I think it makes not much sense to go somewhere else, maybe for price differences. But but if you have one daughter or one kid, you would shop education where you live. I think that makes most sense, or where you intend to live.
Well, I guess I meant for you specifically, not for parents.
Oh, well,
for the message that you might want to spread.
Well, this is very specific. I think the message of free software, open source in education should be spread. But I doubt there's even a free software foundation very active in Russia. I'm not sure even if they have a localized organization or similar organization. And of course, it would be important for such lobby groups who are not directly selling, but just lobbying their ideology or whatever, to be present at such fairs. But it's everywhere in the world. It's a manpower problem. You need the people man the booth. You need some contacts to get a booth for free or for very cost efficient, or you must attach to yourself to a booth of a government organization or big company that needs connections, that needs constant work and organization in the background who can year-round work such contacts and make such deals. And then you still need the people. And then it would, of course, make sense to have speakers in as many locations as possible. Mm-hmm. I was not sure if this conference was very much visited by teachers. I think I had some teachers in the audience, according to the questions I got later. But I had more the impression it was for parents to decide where I go with my children. Or
there were many teachers there.
Well, was there also teachers?
But it was hard to have a sense. I did a workshop that was entirely teachers, okay, and maybe just a few parents.
So it was also for teachers.
So yeah, definitely teachers were going there. Some were bringing their entire classes, but I think in some cases they might not have been in the areas where we were as much, because we were seeing a lot of stuff marketed to
so for free parents. Software and some education
directly
would
to
make
kids.
Sense.
Yeah.
It would make sense to be present.
Yeah, it seemed like yesterday, Saturday was a lot more
day.
Parents.
Yeah, yeah. Ah, okay. Maybe that's my impression.
Smaller families versus classes. Yeah. And we got there towards the afternoon the previous day, and we were kind of more in one area. Cool.
I can add a tiny bit of Moscow general experience.
Yeah.
We were in an underground tunnel
metro.
Crossing the
street. Oh, right.
So we did not cross the street.
Yeah, there are tunnels that are not tied to the metro at all.
Yeah, just a street those. Crossing tunnel, is that correct? And there were two musicians, so one cello, one violin. I have that on camera. I have to upload it on YouTube. And they made very high quality music, I must say, because I'm from Vienna. I'm used that music students make a bit classical music in the pedestrian zone. But this was really high quality what they did. Mm-hmm. I was hugely impressed.
Cool. And what about the metro?
Yeah, metro is a sure experience. They have gigantic metro stations. They're very deep under the earth. We speculated if they're dubbed as nuclear bunkers. And they are all very beautiful. So what you told me, they are each is a bit individual. It's a different design, and they're like, I think this must come from Soviet era, that we make for the workers who daily go to work. We make the palaces not for the rich, but for the workers. So you have a bit the impression this is not, this is a mix of, from a, this is a metro station with the outfitting and the grandeur of a palace. So I think this is very nice because it gives value to the pedestrian and not to the car driver. So I like that.
Yeah, I haven't seen any other metro stations anywhere in the world with chandeliers.
Yeah.
Or that are meticulously cleaned every day. Like, really pretty incredible. And I notice more people meeting. The center's platforms are like meeting places.
Yeah.
They're socialized places.
You basically have
people
a public
have their
place,
dates
a
there.
Public place underground.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which makes sense, I think, because I hear the weather is very harsh long months.
Yeah.
In the year.
Yeah. And what about, was there any other highlights from yesterday? Was really the only day where you had more
tourist
time.
Day, Well, I noticed that despite this tradition of we speculated that in Soviet time individual motorization, so that each family has his own car, was not a top priority. Mm-hmm. But despite that, Moscow is now very traffic, so the streets are 6 lanes broad, even closer to the center, and it's full of cars.
Yeah.
And of course, I would love to live in a city without cars. That's my ideology.
More like Amsterdam.
And I think that in cities like Amsterdam, they are far more wider by valuing the pedestrian and the cyclists. And I have not seen that in Moscow yet. Can can be part because of the temperature, so because maybe in the winter months it would be bad idea to cycle.
See any. I don't remember seeing one bicycle yesterday. Yes, scooters.
Yeah, like but there seems no be bicycle culture here yet. Maybe that will change. Moscow had a lot of changing, I think, over the last years.
Yeah, you don't really see bicycle lanes
on these. So they're still doing all the bad things the Western cities did in the 60s and 70s. They do them now, like.
And it would be very difficult to bring bicycles onto the metro here, not just because they're so crowded, but there are pretty long distances at transfer. And we went to one very prominent tourist place yesterday and one sort of hidden away nerdy tourist place.
Well, the best place to be in Moscow is, of course, the Soviet Time Arcade Machine Museum. I'm very thankful you brought me there. And I was a bit sick and tired, and as soon as I entered, I was complete at good health. And yeah, this is a little cafe run by young people, if I understood that correctly. You can eat burgers there, so they seem to have a good kitchen. And it's two floors of Soviet arcade game machines from the 70s and 80s. This was very nice piece of hardware, and you get a little of 15 kopeke coins that you need to operate them. And yeah, and then you can play along. Some machines were not in good working order. Like you tried a flipper and it was very weak. So you had not even the
first pinball.
And some, the hardware, the joysticks or so were not really functioning. But what I admired was that they remembered me on very early arcade machines of the 70s. I saw as a child where electronic was maybe too expensive or not that developed. So a lot of the mechanic. So like you had really, mechanical, or you should say, if it is a shooting game where you shoot on targets, there's really metal, pins with a paper figure and the pin is moving. And I'm moving the paper figure and you have to try to shoot it. And I was most fascinated by a submarine simulator that really this periscope with a rubber front thing so you can really press your head against it. And one was opened. I have that photographed, so I will link it to it, and you could really see the mechanics. There is really part mechanic and part electric. It would be a nice project to remake. And, you see little ships, they're moving left to right, but sometimes they change direction or move at different speed, and then you can launch a torpedo. But the cool thing is the torpedo has a delay, so for the first seconds you don't even know if it's launched, then you hear a splash, and then you see with a light indicator, you see the torpedo moving, and if you really manage to hit, then there's a very cool effect. The wool box is darkened, the light is out, and you see only a red light showing the exploding ship. So it was with very primitive tools, was a very cool effect made. And yeah, you must, aim before the target a lot. Yeah, and then we played one version. It was even a two-player version, but it was somehow not so good for me. So it was never clear who is shooting, and but it was more difficult with an island in the middle, so you could not always shoot at the ships. They were hiding behind the island.
And each of the arcade games had a placard with the date that it was created. How did the dates compare? Like, say, well, a game from 1986.
I remember that most of the placards say the game was from the 80s, but I guess maybe that was the time they bought the machine or so. So I think the machines were older, but I'm not sure. It could be researched. My impression, if I remember the 80s correctly, we had, at least in Vienna, we had far more modern arcade machines, mostly coming from Japan. And so they had electronic color display. I think none of the Soviet arcade machines had actually real color. They were all black and white, and sweet, and the color was always made with tricks like slides.
Yeah, except that snake game, I think, had color, wasn't it?
That was like a
Commodore 64. But very rudimentary controls. For the most part, it was just like
black, white,
one 2-bit or whatever it would be for black and white.
But they had not really ingenious mix of real hardware with electronic or with mirror techniques. Like this one game I could not play it, but I was very fascinating to watch it. It was a sport car driving simulator. So you had a steering wheel and then you see like a little toy train landscape, but it was basically a circle, but you could not see all of the circle, just the upper half more or less. And there were fixed real toy cars attached to it, so, and they moved with different speed, and you had to steer your car, but your car was de facto a hologram. I think they made it with a half-transparent mirror.
Yeah.
And that was very cool, so you had to calculate the speed of the others, and they will be faster than you, but coming from behind. Mm-hmm. So it was a very nice concept.
Yeah. Cool. And just any other impressions as this is your last day, you'll be heading to the airport in a few hours.
Yeah, I must say I'm very attached to this hotel room in the Holiday Inn Hotel. So if you travel to Moscow, I can personally recommend that, especially if you get it paid. And because this is good internet and yeah.
What about the food?
Yeah, I get some taste of Russian food, the Bosch, you let me cost, and we were in the Hotel Cosmos in a Russian restaurant. Yeah. This was also very nice. It was a restaurant without alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I found the concept very nice. It was full of families, and it was a self-service, so you had an all-you-can-eat buffet with Russian specialties, but also normal food, like schnitzel or potatoes. Cucumber, I think. And fish, I noticed, is prominent.
And how have you been starting your days in this hotel?
Well, with American breakfast, you told me they have big breakfast, but at the moment there's too many people there, so we're doing podcast and wait until the riffraff has eaten so that we can dine like kings.
Cool. It's been so much fun sharing a bit of Moscow. It's my first time showing people around a city that I only barely know. This city is so huge, and I only know a few areas.
I speculate here that you would make far more money by just being Derek and introducing other people to the interesting people you know everywhere. As soon
nerd
as you
tours. Have
nerd tours, make Derek nerd tours.
Cool. Thank you so much for joining me here.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for arranging this invitation.
Yeah, and so for everyone that's listening, Moscow is tourist friendly there and nerd friendly.
Yeah, there are nerd places, there are interesting people. Yeah. And maybe it's better to come in summer time. late spring.
You actually experienced snowfall. I had yesterday snow.
I mean, that's typical. That's how it should be.
Yeah.
I was on the Red Square and it was snowing and cold.
Yeah, it seemed appropriate. Yeah. But today it looks bright and quite a bit warmer. So, difference that a day makes.
As I must say, the most difficult thing to travel to Russia is possibly getting the visa beforehand.
Yeah.
And there was some complications that I learned. So, like, you need someone from Russia to invite you. You cannot just say, I want to visit Russia. Mm-hmm. And the bigger hotels can help you getting this visa.
Yeah, pretty much any hotel, even the smaller ones.
The smaller. No,
There are online services to expedite it, but it's not clear, especially the first time you're going through that.
Yeah, because I just showed the email that I'm invited as a speaker and it was not enough. And then the organization wrote a formal invitation and that was acceptable. But I had to go 2 times to the embassy to learn that. And well, it was all in all not terribly difficult or expensive. It's just something you're not used to as a tourist traveling to Europe.
And we were wondering if Russia is trying to pull past these financial difficulties, that maybe they could increase tourism by at least streamlining the visa process, if not really...
Yeah.
Taking a look at whether there's some way to lift visa restrictions for tourists.
Yeah,
kind of,
Or even if the visa was just a one step guy by the embassy, so you just go to the embassy, pay 10 euros and get a stamp.
Yeah.
That would also, they make it overly complicated, I think.
Yeah.
And I think
you have to go twice. You have to drop off your passport and
then
go back.
Yeah, they need 5 days, I think, to get that. And I think they could really do tourism. I mean, there is a lot to see in former Soviet Union and in Russia. Mm-hmm. It's a big country with very, how should I say, fascinating people, fascinating history.
Yeah.
They could open up.
It's been even more complicated for me because I've often been in foreign countries trying to get a visa for Russia.
Yeah, so, and you think Russia is special? So you need to travel to other countries to get your Russia visa?
Yeah, so if you're on a vacation and you think, I'd like to go to Russia, it's not something you can just do on a menu.
Yeah.
You almost have to go back to your own country and go through this process. If you're doing it abroad, one of the challenges is they have your passport for five days. So you can't go anywhere else. So it's just a little bit extra, but hopefully worth it when you're in Russia.
Something I want to add, because if you're in Western countries, you mostly read the catastrophics or the political things that are not so good in Russia, yes?
Yeah.
And one of them is censorship. And so, and here, at least in the hotel, we had good download speed for internet, and I was surfing a lot. The only site I could not reach was one Ingur picture. I don't know why. But I could read all German and English news site, American TV shows, everything. And you said Pirate Bay's blog.
Yeah, the only website I haven't been able to access since I've been here is Pirate Bay, which seems to be internationally or nationally blocked.
And what I know, but now I repeat here stuff that I read myself in the newspapers, is that that there is censorship, of course, but it's not necessarily for English websites, because that makes no sense for the Russian government to censor the elite, but they have influence of their Russian newspaper and media productions. And that is what the majority reads. I think this plays to the role who can speak English and who can read English.
Yeah.
And what I heard, there's something very important I wanted to add, that the young population, also the Dolmetsch told me that the young population is educated in English in the schools and they can communicate in English.
Yeah.
And maybe I wonder if that will have political implications, if this generation goes older, get more times to vote and get the information from abroad. But the broad mass, like older people, like people over 30, 40, you typically expect them not to understand English. That's also my experience here with street vendors. And
yeah, maybe over 50. And
I must
certainly
say it's
in
not
different
so
industry.
Much different in Austria.
Sure, but we're also meeting a lot of people in education and in technology.
They're
those are
educated.
The sectors where it's most
yeah.
likely to be English speaking.
Yeah. But one very nice thing was we were going in this education fair and before in the street there were a lot of schulchildren and somehow some children overheard us speaking English with each other and a little boy was coming saying, "Hello, mister," or something. Yeah. And then he was so proud to start a communication in English, even if we don't really know how to continue this education. And at the education fair, as we were wandering around, there were some young girls doing marketing I did not fully understood for what, and they all spoke to you and tried to give you their papers or something, and then you said, "No, I speak only English," and that was so nice. They were blushing and red and then hiding behind each other, but still trying to communicate with you with their little English, what they could, and it was very sweet to see the people genuinely enjoying to have a foreigner where they can speak English for the first time in their life, maybe with someone who is not a teacher, but someone who is genuinely a native speaker. And this was very, very worth the visit just to make these people happy to speak English with them.
I find Russia at not just Moscow, but when I was in Vladivostok a few weeks ago, if anything, people are apologizing for not being able to communicate fluently with you, or they feel so bad. They seem so disappointed in themselves. Rather than some places, like there are some stereotypical cities that I won't name where you go and you're shamed for not being able to communicate in the language of the city where you're visiting. I've never felt that in Russia. I've always only felt that.
So the contrast to the French attitude, like.
Yeah. So here it's really about hospitality and being so welcoming and kind.
Yeah. I must also say I'm very impressed with the Russian people. So with this friendliness and.
Yeah. Cool.
The people I met here, of course.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we could sign off and we can head back to the incredible Holiday Inn breakfast buffet.
American breakfast.
Yeah. And it's a mix. It's an interesting mix of American and Russian and international cuisine. So it seems like there's no complete thing. So you probably won't find your favorite thing, but, it's an interesting mix. Yeah. Sort of like our whole weekend.
Podcast, yeah.
Yes. Well, international open buffet.
please take the time to listen to what Pavel said in this podcast. Yeah. I will possibly cut it so that it's now coming, this part. Pavel's questions, and especially Pavel speaking about the government education situation in Russia. And the next podcast will be recorded at an unknown time in the future.
Someday, somewhere.
Meanwhile, if you find interesting articles for International Open Magazine, please send them to me. I will ask the authors for republishing rights they usually granted to me.
Cool. And if you know of any other big international events, especially tied to education and open source, please send them our way and we'll see if we can get there and be invited to a Holiday Inn.
And if you want to meet the most beautiful ladies in the world, just attach yourself to Derek. He will introduce them to you all.
Cool. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Have a beer for me.
До свидания.
До свидания. Пока.
Hi, Horst.
Hi, Pavel. We are here in Moscow.
Yeah.
International Education Fair Moscow. And today is the 15th April 2016.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. 5 p.m.
I'm speaking with...
my name is Pavel Frolov, and I'm publisher of Linux Format magazine. And I listened to your presentation now. It was very interesting information there about
open source
community of educators and some education solution. So I would like to ask more deeper questions about your situation in Austria and maybe in Europe, if you know this. And we have some key point indicator for the education system to find out is it community work good or not good in terms of development of the processes of migrating education systems from proprietary software to free software.
Okay.
So the key questions that we have is the percent of schools and universities which is using GNU Linux operating systems instead of Windows.
Okay. So you take the percentage of universities using free software as an indicator for the free software acceptance in the education landscape.
And this free software mean not, for example, Firefox.
Yeah,
really
operation system.
On the desktops.
On the desktop, yes.
Because everyone is using free software on the servers.
Yeah.
And everyone is using kind of Firefox or Google Chrome now.
I fear I must disappoint you here, yes. I know more from schools than I know from universities and technical high schools and technical universities.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a higher percentage of technical education universities or colleagues who start with 18 years and then finish with an academic degree at like 22 years. They have sometimes computer labs running dual boot or running completely Linux, but I can safely say to my knowledge, at least in Austria, the typical computer lab in a gymnasium, in a school where you enter with 10 and leave with 18, it's mostly the computer lab itself has mostly Windows computers and sometimes Apple computers, and only if the teacher is very interested, he will have set up a Linux computer room, a computer lab, where also with Linux on the desktop.
And what's the situation in the elementary schools and middle schools education?
The elementary schools, I understand this is a primary school where you enter with 6 years old and leave with 10 years old. Are we talking about the same thing? To my knowledge, they seldom have designated computer labs. They sometimes have, or mandatory have one computer in each classroom. And this is typically a Windows computer. But don't need to be, it very much depend on the administrator. And sometimes it depends on the funding. Like if the school is run, also paid for by the government, usually the gymnasium and higher educations are so, then they have government contracts, usually with Microsoft, and they get that paid, so they have very low motivation to actually do something different. If in the other case it's an elementary school run by the district or run by the little village, then there's a higher chance that someone has a clever solution.
Okay, so how do you feel, or maybe you know this exactly, is it situation became better or worse? So is it percentage of rising or going down?
In summary, if you include the Android devices that are finding their way in the classroom, the percentage is rising if you count them also.
But if you compare, for example, Windows, Linux, and MacOS.
I have no hard data for that. I don't believe that Linux is very much rising, if at all. Maybe a bit, because the awareness in the general populace is rising.
Stagnating.
I really can't say. I have no hard data, but I don't have seen a rush or some peak Linux. If at all, it's a slow rising, and it's more that more young educators and more admins have knowledge about free software and then starting to applying them and using it. So it's not, if you ask a normal person about free software, at least they have heard about it. So the amount of awareness is rising, and that slowly will rise also the hardware base, but not fast.
Okay, so situation is improving, but we still
don't improving or stagnant. I can make a dissertated statement to that.
Minds.
I think in my mind, the countries I know, I speak here from Austria mostly, and maybe Germany, they're too rich to care. Some government contract has paid unlimited Windows licenses for every school, why should they care? Sometimes the parents have to pay for the school, additional pay that the students or the parents demand good computer labs, and then they pay something. And then it depends on the parents. Usually, if you have a big group of parents, they are not so well educated computer-wise, and some rich parent then say, yes, I want to have them Windows because I work with Windows. I want that my son is fluent in Windows. So also a case of being too rich.
Okay, thank you. And another question is about free and open source hardware.
Yep.
What do you say about the situation with hackspaces, Fab Labs, and some kind of makers movement?
Like what? I see that's definitely rising around the world, so also in rich countries.
Yes, like Austria. About Austria and your country.
Yeah. So my best knowledge is Austria and Germany, and I see the amount of hackerspaces rising. You may know that hackerspace movement is original from Germany.
Yeah.
Yes, because Californian hackers were visiting Berlin hackerspace, I think, and then transporting the idea back, even if the whole computer movement or hackers movement come from California.
It was very big hacker conference in Germany.
This is the Chaos Computer Conference. Yes. I can recommend everyone to go there. It's always in the end of December in Hamburg. I was there. It's really big. It's like the Burning Man festival of nerds. But to your question, yes, I see rising acceptance and rising usage of open hardware or not so close hardware like the Raspberry Pi, who is not complete open, if I understand
that. Yes, I know this.
I see that rising.
Okay, so in Russia I see some geeks who now move the workstation to the onboard computers like Kubi board.
Okay.
So they take it to the back and just put keyboard, mouse and monitor wherever they are, and they use it as tool for some job that we done, for example, for music. And
okay,
they also use it as an office computer, like email and some documents. Do you see something like this in Austria and Germany?
Not in general schools in a large amount, but it's rising in the technical specialized schools, and everywhere where you have a good teacher, a passionate teacher about technology, he will experiment with these devices at home, and he will try to make that with his students.
Okay. what's the middle age of the Linux geek now?
The Linux geek?
Yeah. And what's the situation? This
I must say I cannot speak for Austria. I only can speak for my own, the people I know. That may be very
your
subjective.
System.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. I say, well, the Linux geek, a young Linux geek can start fairly young, often because of the parents. If the parents confront, I feel that actually I have a bit data of that, because I teach children game programming. And usually the children come to me between age 10 and 13, 15. And I noticed that even the younger children know more about Linux. They are not, they don't know much about it, but they know it from their parents. So I think already our generation is giving this wisdom to their children, to the next generation. So that they start fairly young and sometimes have experience with a Raspberry Pi, because the papa usually buy one and then the children play with it.
What is going on, and what are you thinking about the sector of mobile operating systems? Now we are looking at a new stage of competition between different mobile platforms like Android, Sailfish, OS, Firefox, OS, Tizen, and do you see something in your city about this?
Actually, I see, because I have a bit contact with hackerspaces and podcasters. I run a podcast in German language where very hardware-interested people are using Sailfish and trying to always to have the newest open source or free software operation system on their mobile devices. But I have never seen outside a hackerspace or outside a technical nerd circle anyone mentioning one other operation system other than Android
Firefox,
or
Firefox, or Tizen. Do you see something?
No. Inside hackerspaces you can find such people, but not on the street. To my knowledge, it's they are still in the nerd bubble and not becoming a mass phenomenon like everyone has having Android now.
Mm-hmm. And what is going on with the kind of biological hacking? Like, maybe you know the company from USA, Dangerous Things.
I only know these chips that you can project in, and then you can go have an access card or something.
Yeah.
I never have personally seen something. I just read about it, so I know less about that than
you. Do you know people who make implant these chips?
I'm not sure. There's an artist group from Austria who is very famous. He is Monochrome from Johannes Grenzfurtner. Maybe he had some art action with such a thing. I'm not sure. But I personally know no known of them. I think it can become 20 if it has advantages for the people, like having a Bitcoin wallet in your skin, but I have not seen it yet happen.
I visit one hacker conference, very small and closed in Finland, and there they suggest everyone who wish to make implantation of this, the guy that who I know make this, and then I meet him 6 months later and ask what's experience and impressions, and he said that it seems that this solution now is a little bit useless, and only pass to the metro station that he really can do.
Maybe there's big big market possibility in the medicine sector if you can have some augmented eyes or ears or some cyberpunk thing is just hearing aids.
Do you know something about Global Village project of open source ecology?
Yes, I actually spoken with people who were there, who were in America and volunteered for this open source ecology guy. I think his name is Pavel.
Okay.
No. Okay, we're talking about the same guy. He is from Poland, I think.
I don't know this guy, but I know this project.
Yeah, so what I know is he's from Poland, I think, and gone to USIA, to the rural area, and trying to build his open source village and all the tools to make a little village. And I spoke with guys in Vienna who were there volunteering, I think, one summer, and I don't want to say bad things now because it's only second-hand wisdom that I have. But the impression I had from these guys was that it was all very chaotic, and they said it's not a very organized and structured process. It's also in part of the personality of the people involved. So it's more where the focus of the person is, then there's some progress, and then other things that are not so focused, then there's more disorganization and so.
But do you know about some pilot projects maybe in Europe?
I know one guy who went in the eastern side of Austria at the border to Hungary. He want to make some kind of ecological hackerspace or rural hackerspace, but I have no progress report of him. I can try to check in, but it's on a way smaller scale. It's basically just a garden with a house and internet, and he want to make a hackerspace out of it and with a focus on agriculture and hacking traditional gardening. So a mix of between community garden and rural hackerspace. But it's not in the scope of open source ecology. Of course, all these projects are in contact with each other about the internet, and good ideas tend to multiply themselves.
Okay, Horst. Thank you. It was a group of questions from me about things that I have great interest of, but our topic is education, so let's speak a little about kids and education.
Okay.
So my main question, and we still don't find answer on it in Russia, is how to activate innovation capabilities in the kids. So how to make
innovative, yes.
And how free and open source software can speed up or slow this process, but thinking about this. And maybe you have some examples from your life about this.
Please note that whatever I say now is my highly subjective opinion. It's all about feeling and my own experience. It's not backed up by hard data, so I may talk a bit rubbish now. Yes. So your question was how to make kids innovative in a technical sense?
Mm-hmm. And
and what the role of open source, free open software and hardware is there. My feeling is that you will not make a lot of innovators with closed source or proprietary designs, like, let's say, a Lego Mindstorm, that where you can the electronic device not really hack, not legally hack, and not sell your own improved Lego Mindstorm kits, then I think it will not have much impact on the number of innovators your country will produce. So I think having free and open source software and hardware is a precondition to get innovators. But I also think that just because you take a group of children and bombard them, let's say, by helicopter with one laptop, that's child laptops, or with some open source or free hardware computers, this is not enough. Then also no big innovation will happen. Maybe the plane use the hardware to dig holes in the sand and play sand. You understand me?
Yeah.
So I think it comes down to that you have an ecosphere, a social network, a society where hackerspaces can thrive and blossom, society where teachers who are passionate can make their own afternoon classes and parents and their authorities respect that, where neighborhood activities tend to happen. That's usually in cities, but not necessarily in cities. And if you have such a network, that may be the symptom, it may be not the root, yes? But this is then a network where the plant, so to speak, of innovation in children will blossom more. Is that too poetic? I say you need an environment. You need not one piece of hardware or ideology. And ultimately, it's a network of people. You will not have innovation by putting a children with a big book in a dark room.
Let's put more poetic in this conversation.
Yeah.
So I have two different pictures about this. One picture is a kind of a car.
Car?
Yes. Car. So if we speak about innovative kit like a car, so everything that you mentioned is a kind of handbrake. So if you use proprietary hardware,
we don't have a
network of creative people, we have a car with handbrake.
Yeah, so to speak.
And if we give everything, we will turn off handbrake. But how to press the accelerator? If you want to drive fast, how to press this?
I say no.
You have some ideas about this.
I say no. Something that may be very stupid. It's about my experience of more than 10 years teaching children. Mm-hmm. I think you cannot force it. It's like installing the love to play a music instrument in a child. Yes. Mm-hmm. Some have it from their own, and some will never have it, even if you force them. And some are suitable. So you can seduce them to use that, but if you don't do that, it will not happen. It's the middle ground.
Okay. So
I think the same is with
in my head is a kind of a plant.
Yeah.
So it seems that we can make you to the innovative kids, like in the classroom, like to the flowers, and maybe flowers that still not open.
Yeah.
And we can just
water them.
Water from year to year before they open their flowers. So, and what's the water here? It's information or something else?
I think in a flower you need the earth. And the minerals and the bird
so
droppings.
It's free and open source hardware and software. It's a community, okay? It's earth and minerals. And what's water?
What's water? My guess is, as a teacher, my guess is other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see that...
Community is the water.
Yeah, community between students. That happen if you create an environment where they can all focus without being bullied and without having disciplinary problems or some else problems. And the fascination, I think, does not necessarily come from the teacher directly to the students, but they come if the students inspire each other. But that will seldom happen if not in turn inspired by the teacher. So you need a teacher, but you need also students having fun with each other while doing that, while enjoying learning. The teacher can also be a parent or just a guy in a hackerspace or just some uncle letting them play near his computer in his garage.
And what do you think about some kind of mentors? Like very experienced men, maybe old men with very good knowledge about some technology that can be not a teacher but a friend and a kind of a mentor and coach for the kids.
I'm really guessing here, yes. If you read the biography of Linus Torvald, Just for Fun, he mentioned that he was sitting on the lap of his grandfather, I think, and the grandfather was a computer programmer. It must be back in the 70s. And he wrote in his own biography that he was maybe 5 years or six or something. He was very sure he had absolutely no idea what was happening here, but he loved to sit on the lap of his grandfather while the grandfather coded. So what the grandfather was teaching him actually was that coding is something nice, because he was sitting on his lap, he had grandfather time, he had them only for himself, and of course the grandfather was occupied and he tried to understand or just get the feeling that this is something exciting because grandfather is doing it. Even if he don't understand a word, I think he was analphabet with 5 or 6 years. So I think this kind of emotional stability is maybe the more important part of mention than the actual read this book and do that kind of straightforward teaching that you need for other situations. But was this answering your question?
Yeah.
You can also look up Sugata Mitra's learning experience. He has a TED Talk. He's an Indian educator, and he has this idea that he take a install computer in an Indian rural village and just order a granny to just sit there, don't even interact with the computer, but just watch the children playing with the computer. The meaning is that nobody comes and ruins the computer. So the children is, the grandmommy act as a kind of catalysator. The children feel safe because they can play with the computer, the grandmother is there and makes this safe, so no adult is interrupting or a fight breaks out, and then the children do the learning from themselves. So he creates the environment with the grandmother. So in this case, the grandmother would be the mentor, and her job is mostly admiring the kids or be nice to the kids, but not actually do some teaching. Maybe that goes in the direction also.
It's a very fresh idea for me about grandmother and grandfather. Thank you.
So this key idea of Sugata Mitra is that the job of a grandmother is to admire everything what the grandchild is doing, no matter how stupid and little it is, because that gives the build-up sense, make it proud and inspire them doing more and doing it better.
I have a friend in Spain who invited grandmothers to come into his robotics class.
This so is Derek Breen.
Just inserting a tiny bit.
Yep.
He involved the grandmothers by having the grandmothers teach the kids and guide them for creating the costumes for their robots to give them personality.
Nice.
And it's an extension of the idea that grandparents are the ones who pass down culture, that we get most of our culture from our grandparents rather than from our parents.
This makes actually sense because the parents have to work and are not always there for their children.
So thank you, and my third portion of questions is a little bit deeper conversation about technologies of free open source solutions for education. So could you tell you brand names of that software are you using for operating system in classroom, for classroom management, some additional software, for example, for language teaching, geography teaching, and other subjects, not only programming and computer science.
I must say that I myself teach only programming, so I'm not a geography teacher, and I have no first-hand experience of teaching geography. I just can say the same things I said in the talk before. There are special Linux distributions bundling all these open source and free software applications that are useful for specific teachers, like algebra apps or geometry programs, and they're bundling them in one distro. Yes. What I know is Edubuntu is a flavor of Ubuntu. Is Kole Linux, I think it was Debian-based. I'm not sure what is... No, I think it's Debian-based. Then I know Linux Advanced. It was SUSE-based. SUSE is close to Red Hat. And the Swiss LearnStick or Austrian Linux Advanced projects, both are merged. I think they were Ubuntu-based. I'm not very sure. And all they have in common, that they try to make the life of a teacher or a sysadmin of a school very easy by giving a pre-selected set of applications installed. And then the individual teacher can use them. And of course, if you know a bit about Linux, you can remix your own distribution.
And do you know, maybe you use some solution for web servers and web-based tools for controlling education process, like home tasks and some kind of education matters. So
yeah, like Khan Academy, these progress reports.
Yeah, progress.
I personally don't do that. Well, indirectly, I use GitHub because I teach my students to use GitHub and commit to projects. Then I automatically have a progress report if they're doing something or not. I think that GitHub and version control, like Git, would be the most important tool for non-programming teachers to learn, because it's a tool for collaboration. And everything that you taught now about, like controlling the homework, it's basically a collaboration. So the students are collaborating with the teacher to a project like reaching an education goal or something. And I think instead of using now a Google Drive or so where you all can do that, it would make sense if, let's say, like a math teacher, if he has a little time and thinking, what should I now learn? I have not the time to become full Linux admin. I have maybe a weekend. Then I think the time would be best spent trying to work with GitHub or Git from the command line if he can, and then try to use that in as many different topics in his school as possible. So also the geography teacher and another teacher use that, because with the knowledge of how a version control system works and how you use that, there are services like GitHub, Bitbucket and others, then you could really make every kind of homework, be it whatever the file system is, you can then use that and control it. Was that answering your question?
Another question. Which age of Git are using GitHub?
Well, I can proudly report that in my business, the youngest is 10 years, actually.
10 years, guys, using GitHub.
Using GitHub, has his own GitHub account. But I must say, you should never look at the extreme values, young and old, but you should look at the heap, so at the main average, because you always have one child in every group where the parents, he can reading with 3 years old, and so that's not a, he's not the norm, yes? And for effectively using GitHub, I would say you can start with the average student around 12, 13 years, and at the same time, usually when they get real interesting in programming, text-based programming, so not Scratch. No.
I know guys about 30 who cannot find out how to use GitHub, even after tutorials and so on.
Even with the tutorials.
Yeah,
well,
because it's a very hard concept
maybe,
for their mind.
Maybe you need more attractive teachers. I'm open for hire. I fly to Russia and teach you how to use GitHub. No problem.
And what do you think about GitLab solution?
GitLab. I'm a bit at lost. I don't know what GitLab is at the moment.
It's a kind of standalone GitHub, if you would like
to.
I
think I heard about it. Yes, that's... Must be cool for schools, so they can set it. But basically, with Git, you always can make your own service. And edit that out.
asked.
Okay. I forgot we all had should go in the flight mode, so maybe we have a signal on the microphone sound file. You know, a noise signal from the phones, but it's no problem. I can make a transcript and send it to you. We finish?
Yes.
Okay, thank
you. So you can ask some questions if you would like.
I'm making a new file. International Open Podcast, part 5. issue 5, part 2. It's April 2016, the 15th. We are in International Education Fair Moscow. I'm Horst Jens. Next to me sit Derek Breen, and I sit next to Pavel.
Yeah. I'm Pavel Frolov, and I'm General Director of GNU Linux Center project and the publisher of Linux Format Russia magazine.
Wow. Pavel, you work a lot with promoting and making possible free software and open source education for Russian schools.
Yes.
Can you say how did you come to this line of business? What was the reason you got into this area?
About 15 years ago, we hold an internet shop with CDs and DVDs with software. And we find out the extremely high demand of the CDs with GNU Linux and FreeBSD operating systems. And it was so huge demand that we decided that we need to do separate project. So we established internet shop named linuxcenter.ru, and we made a proposal that you can order CD or DVD with different Linux distribution, and we will send it by post to you. And it was very big business for us for several years.
So you had a mail order Linux distribution,
yes,
distribution service.
Yes.
Cool. And what is linuxcenter.ru doing now? What is the main activity?
Next step of our development was publishing books and some educational materials. Then we start to publish Linux magazine. And we do it for 10 years. Well, last year it was 10 years of Linux Format magazine Russia. And then we start to provide services for the government customers and for business customers of migrating or some consulting or some development based on free and open source systems.
So you're selling know-how and expertise.
And developers work also. Mm-hmm. And now Linux distribution business is not good because everyone can download everything, but we do some services and we do some solutions like free open source hardware and software bundles, like robotic kits or some boxes who play internet radio or some boxes for internet security like firewalls and so on. And we also do some services in the internet, like solution, for example, for internet TV and internet radio based on free and open source stack.
I will follow with some generic questions about situation in Russia,
okay,
regarding open source. I hope they are not offensive. They are from my very little small wisdom, yes, from Austria. First question, what is the popularity of free software, especially Linux, in Russia? Historically, I had the impression the need was not so big years ago because you can for next to nothing get a pirated version of Windows, and there were no American laws who would in any way harm you if you do that, so there was not so much need to get a Linux because you can have a Windows basically for free. What is the truth?
The GNU Linux operating system and FreeBSD and so on are really popular on web servers.
Mm-hmm.
More than 15 years and it's totally dominated. They also totally dominated on supercomputers.
Yep.
Not only in Russia, all over the world. They almost kill the market for the operating systems. As for desktops, I think that now we have one or two persons of desktops that using Linux, but if we don't mind the Android operating system, because Android is very popular on the mobile phones and on tablets. And also very many people using OpenOffice and Firefox and
so they're on top on a proprietary system, they use free software.
Yes. Okay. Kind of Google Chrome or maybe Gimp or Blender and so on. We have several organization who is totally using free open source systems. For example, with this very huge network of food stores. Its name is Magnit.
Okay.
And it's one of the most largest networks all over the world. Maybe top five or top three. And they have more than 5,000 stores, and they use only open source.
Very cool.
Sorry, Hurst.
Yeah,
we need to close exhibition now.
Okay.
So maybe we can continue a little bit later.
Yeah,
because
no problem.
In 5 minutes, everyone will
rush.
So I told
interview
about
with Pavel. Magnet. Continue. Question was about how Russian government is reacting to idea of open source and free software.
The Russian government is very hard to understand term, because in fact Russian government is 25 ministers and several secretaries.
So it's complex.
So it's kind of minister of finance, minister of transport, minister of communication, and so on. And of course, minister of finance and minister of transport doesn't know anything about free software. But in fact, we have our prime minister Dmitry Medvedev, and he is very good in understanding of free and open source software and Linux operating system. And he even, I don't sure if it's true for 100%, but I heard that he tried to install different Linux distribution on his laptop by himself.
Ah, really? Yeah, that's a story in itself. That must be the first prime minister worldwide.
And he was the president of Russia, and he was the person who was personally responsible for the modernization of education system in Russia, and also for installing Linux operating system in Russian school.
So every Russian school has now a Linux operating system?
No, it was a plan, but it was failed.
Okay.
There was a pilot project in three regions, but Russia is a huge country, so each region is a kind of big European country. So in three regions, it was Perm, region, Tatarstan, and Tomsk region. There was a pilot project of migrating all schools to GNU Linux, and there was many methodological and educational materials that was developed to help teachers to migrate, and there was a big program of improving qualification of teachers to using free software in schools. It was not very good because there was hiring. They tried to do very fast. It was kind of a mistake. So it was better if this project was for 3 years, but they tried to do everything for 1 year, so the quality of education was bad. But They tried to make education for 10 or 20,000 teachers how to use free software, and then they sent CDs with Linux operating systems to each school of Russia and say, okay, you can use it. And then they say that Russian government will not give money anymore to the school for buying software. So they have now two options. Or the region government pay, for example, to Microsoft.
Yep.
Or they can use free software. And some regions buying licenses from Microsoft, and Microsoft was have to lower prices, very low, 10 times or so for the whole region. Because in other cases,
so they used
the whole region. And
so they used the free software as leverage to get better prices for Microsoft.
Some regions, yes, some regions are going to GNU Linux and free software, and there are several regions who made decision that we don't go to the Microsoft.
And they're still using Linux, or
yes, yes.
Okay.
And also this process leave a little bit steps on the sand, and many teachers now heard about Linux, and many enthusiasts and early adopters using Linux, and there are whole schools in different regions which using GNU Linux and other stuff, and this beautiful girl that come to you and ask who you are is the government member of St. Petersburg. And she was established the work group of using free software in schools of St. Petersburg. So they do conferences twice a year and share experience and invite different company whose business is service in open source. And in St. Petersburg we have about 700 schools, and about 100, maybe from 1 to 200, are using Linux and free open source. And there was also one guy with some mustaches, and he is the vice director of one school, which is pilot school for government of St. Petersburg, which use free software in every aspect of school process, even for geography or English language and so on. And they make a methodological papers, and other schools, they share this methodological, other schools can take this experience and use it too. So, and I'm sure that it's not only one case, so it's a kind of the first project, the big Linux project for schools, a kind of throwing seeds everywhere, and some seeds now blossom, growing. Yeah. And I think that this process will grow. But now no one is speeding it up, no one helps. So it's a kind of a plant that's growing by themselves as they wish. Kind of jungle. So this is situation in schools. So in government the situation is quite the same, and we have federal government structures, different ministers, different agency, about 60 or 80 organizations, and about 6 years ago the government make a plan of total migrating to free open source of all federal ministers. Our group was involved in making this plan. So in our first version of this idea, it was 3 years plan, but they say that it's too fast, so it should be only at least 5 years, and maybe then we have time to make new 5 years or something. But there was very good plan, and there was very strange situation because bureaucrats decided not to do anything. They have plan. It was written by, signed by Putin. But almost everyone in federal structures decided to not migrate to free open source. But there was one organization who do everything for this plan. It's, I don't know the English word, but for Russian it's Федеральная служба судебных приставов. So this is federal service of officers which taking debts from the people, a kind of department of police.
So finance police or something?
Not finance police, but if someone is own money, for example, for the...
So it would be like the Internal Revenue Service in like the United States.
Maybe.
That collects taxes.
Yes,
and,
they,
and
they collect not penalties.
Yeah,
but
not
important
taxes, but penalties.
Of government.
No.
Yes.
For the state.
And they do everything. So they do their own Linux distribution. Mm-hmm. They make certification for security. They made education. And they have about 50,000 computers and servers. Mm-hmm. And they migrated all servers and 10,000 computers.
Wow.
This is situation for the last year fall. Maybe now it's more.
Sure.
So they do everything and they share the solution to other ministries. So every ministry and every local government of the region now can take this. They, my name is GOS Linux, and GOS made government. So it's government Linux. They do this and everyone can download it from the government site and use it for migrating.
Interesting.
So this is very good case.
But this is only one branch of government. It's not that all government
and other
agencies
government structure using several servers, several computers with open office and so on. But this total migrating, like was described in this plan, only one organization was due, and we trying to find out why this happened, and we find out that the key issue here is education. Because people who was
the process?
Who was told to migrate doesn't know anything about Linux. Anything, doesn't know anything about free software. And they don't have the images in their mind. They know only Windows. And it's almost impossible to make these people to do something with Linux. You need to re-educate them.
Sure.
Do you know from any cities or towns who completely switched the government of the district or the city?
There are several cities in Russia who totally migrated to Linux and free open source.
And that worked?
Yes, everything is good.
Can you give one example of such a city?
For example, in the Primorsky region near the Vladivostok, there is a small city named Chernigovka.
So and they made complete
migration 7 years ago.
And do you think they will continue doing that, or will they with the next shift of government directive going back?
The chief.
Aha.
So I know very big projects of migrating, for example, Federal Fund of Social Insurance. It's about 25,000 computers, and they make total migrating for OpenOffice and for free software on the several servers, and they do their own database on free open source engine. And they do this for 5 years. It was very successful project. And then the chief officer go to another work, and another chief officer say, what are you doing here? Where is my Microsoft Office? Where is my Oracle database?
This seems to be an international problem. I know this story from my country and from several countries. Do you know something? Because I imagine that the Russian military is one of the few militaries in the world who will not happily use American software.
Yes, for our military warships has and so. Several Linux distribution self-development.
Self-development. Have, but this does not spill over to civil government, so they make their own thing, no, the military.
Now they have option of selling several distribution to the government too, but the distribution are not very cheap.
Oh.
So it's expensive solution.
Can I also ask, what do you think about the level of education, especially of computer science education in Russia, in view of a global play field? So you, I think Russian engineers are compete against India, against Eastern Bloc, America, Chinese engineers.
If you ask about coding, just coding, so I think that Indian coders can be more competitive because they have more people. There is about a billion people in India and only 140 million in Russia.
So the law of large numbers.
Talking about architects and some big-minded people, the key issue here is mathematics.
Yeah.
So mathematics schools in high school and also many secondary schools in Russia are very good. So some universities has best mathematics educational program in the world, and our mathematics are very cool mathematicians. And these guys very often won or wins World Olympic games in programming. And they're really cool. So if you look carefully to the American companies like Microsoft or Intel, you'll find many Russians who do many Google in programming, so who do many jobs, very important jobs. But if you're talking about simple coding, our guys are not so cool that other country because it's boring, and Russians are not like boring tasks. If you need to solve unsolved in the world problem, call to Russian guy. He will do this. If you need to code for 5 years for the instruction that's going from the head office to you, Russian guy will fail this. And another problem or difference in education is different roles in not computer science but computer business. So we in computer business we need to have good marketing. We need to really good understand which market sector we want to target our solution. And we need to have very good usability. And we need to have very good focusing on local markets, because in different countries you have different demand on some functions and usability and even service. And our education system now is not good in this. So we have different projects in education system, like maybe you know, Innopolis University. So in Kazan, in Tatarstan region, we're going to build, we already built this big university who will teach computer science. Mm-hmm. So to find out how to teach this, we was need to send people to take experience on the good and large universities in the world who are good in this, for example, Carnegie Mellon. So they sent our ambassadors to Carnegie Mellon, and they studying there, and then they come back and try to teach which the things they studied to the Russian students. But we have gap here. So very good mathematicians, okay, but not good marketolog people, marketing people, okay, not good UX designers, and not good coders, because coding is more the discipline than creativity.
Okay.
You just need to do some tasks in good methodology like Scrum or Agile or so. But we have very strong outsourcing company that is going to, that is going, they're in top 100 of the world's largest software companies. They have thousands of employers here who do many things, both in coding and both in creating new solution for many customers, even for the government of your country and USA or some projects in medicine or so on. So, many times you can find situation when big projects is doing by some company from Russia who has, for example, 2,000 or 3,000 programmers who is know how to do everything right, but they teaching, they studying this about 20 years. So they really good in everything. Sorry, interview.
What is your opinion of the level of internet infrastructure in Russia? Is there a big difference between centers like Moscow and St. Petersburg? Or can you say that you have equally good internet connection and quality of teachers and quality of universities across the country?
Russian government, and it was also Dmitry Medvedev who was responsible for it, spent a lot of time, money and resources to make very good internet connection for every school of the Russia. So every school of the Russia has good internet connection, and now almost every place in Russia has also good internet connection, but we have several villages very far from big cities or big transport pipes. But we also have 3G and 4G wireless internet. And for example, in my phone, all over the Russia, I can have internet connection from 10 to 80 megabits per second.
Wow.
In my phone.
Yeah.
It's very fast.
Yeah.
So you say you have good internet connection,
yes.
Maybe a part of some connection. Small villages who are hard yes. to reach.
Okay. Everyone who want to have good internet connection can have it, and it's not much expensive.
So, yes,
for example,
so much less expensive than the US.
I pay for my phone internet connection about $4 per month.
And every school has good internet connection. So every school or university has.
Yes. So no problem with internet connection we have, except small villages, but government is giving money for some. Because our idea is that everyone should have good internet connection.
What is your opinion about the attractivity of the economy of Russia for good educated coders and mathematics. As you said before, a lot of Russian educated mathematics end up working in America for Silicon Valley companies. You think the Russian economy is attractive enough to hold enough good educated people, or do you basically invest in them and then they leave the country?
I know some people who come back from USA and now they live in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people who go out from Russia mm-hmm. and live now in USA, and it seems that it's free migration from country to country, and the most bad thing in Russia now, it's the climate. So it's the most complaining thing to discuss with people. They say, oh, we get sick in winter. Oh, we have so much raining. And we would like to move to the country where the sun is shining every day. So this is very often needed reason to migrate.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of money or security, the situation is quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of kind of startup, the USA is much more harder to go to market because you need to do many things with patents. It's mm-hmm. It's very expensive and it's hard way to market. And in terms of abilities, in Russia now you have more abilities than in other countries, and there are many people who live in sunny countries, but they earn money in Russia. They go to Russia for salaries. Okay. They come back to their families to the sunny country.
Final question, what is your opinion about mandatory coding in school, like Little Estonia, I think, made a curriculum that every 13-year-old get 1 year of coding in school. So learn to code in the school for everyone, not only for specialist classes. You have such regions or some
in Russia,
plans that
everyone,
you know?
Using coding in school too.
Really?
Yes.
And can you say what age or what?
About 12 or 13 years old.
So this is for every child in Russia?
Yes. But the problem is that they teach in Pascal.
Okay. Maybe that
so
will change.
We really need to change this to teach in Scratch, for example, at first, and then C++. Because Pascal is useless. Mm-hmm. And there is big problem with school kids who go from school. So, do you know programming? Yes. Which language you can? Pascal.
It also makes me suspect that the curriculum would be pretty old model of curriculum. If they're still focused on Pascal, then they're probably still using the same lessons of the 80s or whenever it was that was implemented. How long ago was that program set into place so that all children would be studying coding for at least a year?
They studying coding about 1 hour a week, and it lasts for several years, about 5 years.
And how long have the schools been that consistent with coding? Because that it sounds like Russia is way ahead of most of the Western world. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of these other countries, including the USA, are only just starting to make it a requirement?
I don't know.
Oh.
I cannot
predict
this.
So, for a good while, it sounds
but
like.
But I hope that it will last forever.
Yeah.
Because it's the right thing to study programming in schools. Mm-hmm.
A personal question, do you think the free and open source movement in Russia is strong enough to survive a government shift? Let's say some other prime minister say we don't have money for that, we don't want to support free software anymore. You use that and that Windows.
In fact, money for supporting free and open source movement are not paying, not spending. So it was spent very small amount of money in Russia for this. And free and open source movement are development independent of government support. Okay. And this is mean that they develop slowly, and sometimes they have problems, and sometimes people go out from this movement and do something else. But they also very... very strong. So they develop without support, so it's very hard to stop them.
Okay, so you think it's strong enough?
They're strong enough, but they're really small. It can be much more.
Could be more.
More if they give support, but maybe it can be a bad solution too, because if they will be thinking that every time he wants money, someone will come and give this, they will become weak. Yeah, now our free and open source guy are really cool. It's the kind of digital Jedi's of the future.
Oh. One extra question. Do you see there's an ecosphere of independent hacker spaces, maker spaces, little innovative firms growing out of student projects also in Russia blossoming, or is that hard for political or
this
some other reasons?
This is very funny questions because of my answer of previous question, because this movement are really supported by government, and they spend huge amount of money to open Fab Labs.
Let me repeat it. The Russian government is paying to open Fab Labs and
yes.
Hackerspaces?
Yes. They pay for.
I'm speechless.
They pay for opening 200 Fab Labs for last 2 years.
Well,
and in Moscow we have more than 20 Fab Labs now. In each district of Moscow, kids can for free come to Fab Lab and find 3D printers, digital fabrication machine like laser cutting, or so on. And Russian government are working very hard to activate creativity of kids, to make them innovative and some startups and so on.
And how
so
is
it's big government program, and they don't seem to stop this.
And how is it if students want to make their own thing? So not
no problem, we can for free.
They
do
don't get difficulties like saying it's hard to find a rental space or getting allowance. So it's really
yes. And we also have supported. Independent.
Yeah, also space. They're not discriminated or something.
Yes.
Wow, it's really cool. So of all that, I hear from you that you look very optimistic in the future of Russia as a free software producing country. Is that true? My impression.
Yes.
Yeah. You already feel that you are attracting programmers or nerds from other countries because of
only
this
Derek.
Project. Only Derek.
But well, some guys are attracted for Innopolis. So Innopolis offer some grants for professors to come to Innopolis and hold the computer science works. And I think, and some guys was attracted by Skolkovo and Skoltech.
Okay, thanks Pavel a lot for this interview. And good luck with your whole activities. I hope we see each other again in a next meeting or conference.
Das wieder.
Das wieder.
Bye bye.
Oh, wow.
Auf Wiedersehen.